Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to my friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. I'm Karen Tate, and tonight's musical offering opening the show was an upbeat little snippet from Be Optimistic. It's a band from across the pond, and that song was a tribute to the divine feminine called Maria. But let's turn our attention to tonight's show right away here. I will be having a What's the Buzz segment after my interview with Laura Flanders of Grid TV. During the What's the Buzz segment, I'll be sharing an article from the New York Times about how some researchers in California have found it to be that upper-class folks, in spite of their advantages, well, sometimes they suffer empathy deficits and have not in many cases developed effective social skills that engender goodwill. I found that really interesting. And to close the show, we're going to be talking about Keith Olbermann leaving MSNBC last week. I don't know about you, but it felt very strange tuning in to MSNBC at 5 o'clock on Monday this week and his voice being absent. In honor of Keith, here on the show, I'll be counting down the weeks until Keith's contractual obligations allow him to return to television. So stay tuned in with me through the end of the show. But now, turning my attention to our special interview tonight, we have with us a woman I suspect many of you already admire. She's Laura Flanders. But in case that name doesn't ring a bell for you yet, I'm sure you'll be following her work after tonight, scanning your cable channels and internet to see where you can get her and how you can get her on a regular basis. She is a former Air America radio host, and right now she is the host and founder of Grit TV, a nationally syndicated daily talk show for people who want more than talk. She writes for the Huffington Post and TheNation.com, and she's a regular contributor on MSNBC. She's appeared on shows from Real Time with Bill Maher and The Tavis Smiley Show to Larry King Live and Bill O'Reilly Factor. You can even follow her on Twitter, and her name on Twitter is at Grit Laura, and you can watch Grit TV daily online at gritTV.org or on Dish or DirecTV Satellite on Free Speech TV. She's also an author, and that's really what we're going to sort of focus on mostly tonight. She's the author of the New York Times bestseller, Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species and Blue Grit, True Democrats Take Back Politics from the Politicians. But it's her new collection that we're going to highlight tonight, and it's called At the Tea Party, The Wingnuts, Whack Jobs, and Whitey Whiteness of the New Republican Right, and Why We Should Take It Seriously. So, Laura, welcome to Voices of the Sacred Feminine.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
Well, you know, I just saw you on the Ed Schultz show, I think it was yesterday, and I have to tell you, I was cheering you on. You know, you stood up to that Republican woman and her distractions, and I just want to thank you for being one of the ones that doesn't let them get away with it and hold their feet to the fire when they
lie. Well, I really appreciate that. It's amazing how they can come up with, you know, two women finally in conversation, but of course we have to be at each other's throats. And they find a woman of color who is a conservative. Amy Holmes has played that role for years. You know, it's been an interesting few decades, I think, watching how cable have opened their doors to women, but which women? That's the question.
Well, yeah, I mean, and at some point, and, you know, and I don't know, we'll see if we have time tonight. I'm really curious about your book, Two Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species, because I don't really understand that brand of woman very much. And,
yeah,
you know, maybe it seems like maybe you've done a study.
Well, in case people think we're talking about women in Africa, no, we're talking about women in the Bush administration, the cabinet members who were an inner circle members who were women, Condoleezza Rice, Gail Norton, that crowd, Karen Hughes. It was a great opportunity to study some very strange characters quite closely. And the book still holds up. I think it prefaces or presages a lot of what we've seen since with the treatment of, Michelle Bachmann, Sarah Palin, and more.
Okay. Well, and thank you for making that, for clarifying that point, too. We don't want anybody to think we're talking about, you know, women who live in Africa or even Australia, for that matter.
There are a few people who think it became a sudden expert in the, pygmies of the Kalahari.
Well, they maybe thought you went on extended vacation or something.
Oh, if only.
But let me just give the title of your book again tonight that we're going to be talking about and tell people where they can get it. Again, it's At the Tea Party. It's a collection of articles from folks from The Nation, Mother Jones, Truthout, The Progressive, many other sources. These many experts, well, they've come together to shed some light for us on the Tea Party so we can sort of dissect who they are. And now, you can't get it in stores, though. Well, let's say that before we get engrossed in our conversation. You have to go, you can download it. And where can you download it, Laura?
You can't get it in stores, which means it's special. And it's available direct to you when you go to the website Or Books. It's orbooks.com. Think of it as, you know, sandwiches or books. Orbooks.com. And you can download an electronic version, or you can get a soft paperback sent directly to your home. It's an effort to kind of do an end run around companies like Amazon that are driving prices down for books and are contributing a portion of their profits to conservative causes, and also to sort of save the environment, that we're not sending lots of books all across the country to bookstores only to have the excess sent back again with all of the, you know, associated spoilage of both paper and gasoline and all the rest. In this case, it's really an on-demand book. You get the book when you want it, but it is a real book. I guarantee people it will be indistinguishable from the other books on your bookshelf.
Well, I have one right here in front of me, and that's absolutely true. And another thing I love about it, besides all the different, left voices that are in it, I like that each story or chapter or entry, the essays, they stand on their own. So you can put it down and come back to it, you know, a week later or an hour later, and, you know, you haven't lost the thread.
Yeah.
Because they're all talking about the Tea Party, but, you know, each essay is sort of its own topic about the Tea Party.
Well, I appreciate that. And I will say also that while there are, yes, indeed, lots of your most popular left voices, people like Melissa Harris Perry and Chris Hedges and Jim Hightower and Glenn Greenwald, there are also some of the pieces I'm most happy about in the book are transcripts from conversations we've had on the Grit TV show, some of which include people who are members of the Tea Party, sympathizers with the Tea Party. Those have been some of the most interesting conversations that we've had. And the whole book was, in fact, inspired by somebody who was in my very close circle, part of my extended family, who I found one day was a Tea Party sympathizer, or more than that. So, yeah, there's a left critique here, but I think progressives are also put on notice that this isn't a phenomenon just far away, crazy people. It's actually quite close and very important for us to grapple with.
Well, I know they're in my family.
Yeah, there you go.
So, let me just read the back of the book. I really like that, and then we'll get on to the chat and the questions I have for you. It says, something's brewing, and it doesn't smell good. It's tempting to see the Tea Party as a bunch of crazies, as the widely celebrated broadcaster and best-selling author Laura Flanders argues in this compelling anthology, but it would be a mistake to dismiss the dangers of the meeting of money, moment, and media that has produced the Tea Party phenomena. With contributions by a wide range of leading experts, At the Tea Party looks at who's behind the movement, its rich sources of funding and extensive use of new technology, its appeal to women, the pervasive racism that underpins much of its approach, and the lessons for the left of a political program that, though often incoherent, nonetheless taps into genuine anxiety. So Laura, you know, here on Voices of the Sacred Feminine, I really wanted to talk to you about this movement, these people, because they seem to be really the opposite of everything myself and my listeners believe in. You know, we care about social justice. We believe in interconnection among peoples and the planet. You know, we would like to think that we could eventually have more sustainability over, growth that, that goes unchecked. You know, we want partnership, not domination, or a survival of the fittest culture. But tell me if I'm wrong, but the Tea Party seems to be the complete opposite. You know, they come across at least as sort of crass, chaotic, and a callous bunch. Are my perceptions wrong?
No, I don't think you're wrong. There's two things here. One, I think the reason I got interested in this subject was not just because of the prospect of yet another right-wing movement, but because of the way that much of what is cast as a Tea Party fringe perspective these days is actually the party we're all attending. It is, in fact, very much the sort of conventional wisdom, not just on the fringes of our political scene, but right at the center, and we can talk more about that. I mean, in the past election, 40% of voters in exit polls said that they support or sympathize or feel drawn to Tea Party candidates, and you can say that that's scary and they're misguided and crazy, but the reality is we are all now grappling with this phenomenon. We are all, if you like, at the Tea Party. And as I argue in the book, at the introduction of the book, you know, this is not the beginning of something. This is kind of, I call it the Bacchanal. You know, it's Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin celebrating the culmination of a process that I think has been decades in the making, of pushing back against exactly that worldview that you described, that would be easy to associate with the civil rights movements, the women's movements, the gay and lesbian equality movements, the anti-war movements, the ecological movements of the 70s, 60s and 70s. It's a backlash against all of that and an effort to replace those values or head them off at the path, if you will, with instead a very atomized, individual, private realm-focused world. And I think, frankly, I mean, we're talking the day after President Barack Obama delivered his State of the Union address, where I'm afraid you have to say that worldview kind of rules. The private company will save us. Private enterprise will save us. We need to save our entrepreneurs from the onerous burden of increased taxes. In fact, we want to lower taxes on the least taxed sector of our society, namely corporations, and continue on a path that has really brought us into complete, I think, division in this society, with a tiny few doing very well and the rest of us really struggling to keep our head above water.
Well, you see, that's the part I don't understand. Well, first, you've sort of dispelled one of my thoughts, about the Tea Party. I thought, well, maybe if we had a white president, this wouldn't have come to be. But because, there's so many racist elements, or at least there seems so in the Tea Party, I thought maybe he was maybe the last straw on the camel's back, so to speak. And I thought maybe that's why they were born, but apparently not.
Can talk about that. I mean, let's talk about race and the Tea Party, because I think it's an important part of the story. But it's not, I don't think, the explanation for what's happened. I think racism functions in our society as a kind of, lighter fluid. You know, we keep it handy for when we really want to start the bonfire. And progressives, the left, the middle, the right, none of us in our post sort of apartheid America have ever decided to actually put aside the weapons of white supremacy. We have not actually decided to disarm those tools, and we bring them out when we need them to vilify people on welfare or to suggest that maybe that other primary candidate couldn't possibly win the Democratic nomination. Those hot buttons of racist attitudes are easy to push When you spray a little of that fluid on any situation, you can ignite an enormous fire. So I think that it has been an accelerator, of course, the race of the president. And it's at the same time been a wake-up for all of us at just how potent those racial resentments and attitudes still are. So that's how I would look at it. Not irrelevant, very relevant indeed, but not sufficient, if you like. You know, it's adequate but not sufficient, if you want to talk science, to bring about the Tea Party phenomenon.
Okay, because, you know, I'm from the South. I remember what that racism was like. I mean, fortunately, you know, I haven't lived there for 25 years, and I guess you sort of forget. But, you know, when we would see all of the ugly racist signs at the town halls and at the rallies, I just couldn't imagine that to have happened if Hillary had won the White House.
Can't you imagine what the signs would have been? I mean, let's not forget one thing.
I mean, wash my shirts or something like that.
Absolutely. I mean, again, I don't want to shed differences, and racism is different from sexism, but absolutely, I think that if we were in a moment like we were in the fall of 2009, or rather the spring of 2009, the fall of 2008, with an economy in crisis, and the powers that be in this society realizing the potential for true unrest in this nation, and an unrest that would look at what it was that had caused the economic recession of that season, and what it was the deregulation of the profit sector in this society, and what it was the deregulation of corporate business and the permission of that we've all conceded to private companies that they can simply privatize the profits of globalization and share the spoils with none of the rest of society.
Well,
it was
a moment
of true unrest, and I think that if Hillary Clinton had been the president, we would have seen the same sorts of tools used against her, not race, but gender-based, for the very same reasons.
Okay, all right, I'll give you that. Well, the other part of this is, you know, and you sort of touched on it already, is, you know, they seem to want to perpetuate the very policies and ideas that have sort of gotten us here. I mean, are they that uninformed, or, I mean, how can they want to keep doing the same thing and expect a different result? I mean, that's like the definition of, the opposite of logic.
Well, think about it. I mean, we've got two groups of people that we're talking about here. One is the Tea Party followers, like my friend and your family and, you know, the people that we all of us know. They're not the leaders. They're not the funders. They're not the ideologues. They're the people who've been looking for some kind of explanation for what's happening in their lives. And maybe they have their own personal reasons to feel uncomfortable with a black president. And they're not so personal. They're political. But be that as it may, maybe they've got their own sense of anxiety about change and the coming millennium of a multiracial society. Maybe they feel hard done by, and that's the only story that they've ever been told. It's all pieced together for them very conveniently, a worldview by somebody like Glenn Beck. But a Glenn Beck or the Koch brothers or Dick Armey, who are in the leadership of this mobilization, I think bear a very different responsibility and have a very different agenda than most of the Tea Party followers that you or I would bump into. And I think that's very important for us to realize, because it affects us as progressives when we think about what our tactics are. You know, is our neighbor who is a Tea Party subscriber the enemy? Well, if he's the enemy and if he's just a racist pig, you know, what are our options when it comes to making change? I prefer to believe, and I think it's true, that our responsibility remains to talk to folks, to try to talk some of this through, and, you know, not just laugh at the ignorance or the arrogance or the failure to understand, but try to erode some of that while we talk about the interests of those who are pushing this agenda. Because as you say, for you, me, and our friends and relations, continuing to do the same has only produced disastrous results. But for those at the top of our society who've seen wealth accrue to them unlike anything we've seen in the history of this nation, 60% of all the profits in this country going to the top 1% of this country's people, it has worked for them. And we may say, this is very short-sighted because actually you still live here with the rest of us and the planet's heating and the people are starving and what do you think's going to happen? But in terms of their bank balance, in terms of what they've come to believe about how they deserve this, this has all been working very well for them.
Right. Well, you're right. Because, I know I saw four of the so-called leaders of the Tea Party on The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell. And, I mean, they weren't the Koch brothers or Dick Armey or anybody like that. They were just the public faces,
right,
you know, of the Tea Party. And it was obvious they weren't the brains behind the organization. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they didn't have a good understanding of economics or politics. They just seemed angry and misinformed. And, you know, I got to tell you, I did almost feel a little sorry for them. But I wonder, do they know that they're being used, or by the corporations, the very people who they should be directing their anger against? Do they think they're a grassroots movement?
Well, I think that they do. I mean, it's been very, very important that an economic movement that is for reinscribing the economy that we have here, which is the economy of the aristocrats and the economy of the super rich, at the expense of everybody else. It's very important that that have a populist, just Joe Schmo, Joe the plumber public face, in the same way that a Republican Party emerging from a history of supporting segregation had a face of women and people of color like the people that I wrote about in the Bushwoman book. It was very important that, you know, Ronald Reagan, as he tried to roll back civil rights, had Clarence Thomas at the head of the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, working at the Equal Employment Opportunity Administration. You know, he had to be the face in the same way that, you know, Linda Chavez is the face of English-only education against affirmative action. Ward Connolly, same thing. So we're very familiar with this kind of straw man public face of a very different private agenda. But if you said to Clarence Thomas, for example, don't you know you're being used, I think, you know, he would tell you the same thing that some of the Tea Party leaders say, which is absolutely not. I'm part of a movement that values me, that treasures me, and in fact, I'm treated very well here, and I believe in the cause.
Yeah, but, you know, Clarence Thomas and his wife, they're way up the food chain, you know.
Yeah.
I'm thinking more about the people down at the bottom that the corporations are really hurting, and they're voting against their economic interests. You know,
well,
the
I
average
absolutely
person,
agree. I'm just saying,
you know,
that's
yelling at the town hall meeting, you know.
He's the public face of anti-civil rights.
Yeah.
Working against his own interests and the interests of the people he, against his own interests and against his own history of how he got to be where he is, in the same way that some of those Tea Party people are working against their own interests as they scream for fewer taxes and for fewer social services, even as we know from some polling, at least, that these are folks who send their kids to public school, who are on Social Security, and most of them don't actually think that the taxes they personally pay are too high.
Right. Well, okay, so we've sort of, you know, covered what is the Tea Party, I think. Where does the Tea Party really get its real power?
Well, I think we have a lot of people in trouble in the society in a very troubled democracy. And the power, I think, comes from a big vacuum in the center of our democratic discussion where there should be some honesty about what has happened and what needs to go on. I mean, I listened, so I think they get their power from a vacuum where the left would be. But the left isn't allowed mostly in the public debate. So instead you get these rather shriveled up debates. I mean, think about it. Barack Obama gets elected in the fall of 2008. The long shot candidate, the guy with the ears and the strange name and Hussein in the middle of his name. Nobody thought he would win. He wins with a vast majority. He sees, you know, a democratic shift comes into power with majorities in both houses, an economic crisis. How does this become a conservative moment? You know,
right.
How
they're
did that get turned
they're
around?
Masters. their masters. I mean, it's like right after the November election, all you heard was the people have spoken. Well, did they forget after Barack Obama was elected, the people spoke then too? I mean, look at all the people that were, out on the lawn that night. You know, people crying their eyes out, thinking things were going to be different, and you know, they could really have hope, and things were going to change. And
but look at
like
what
the
happened.
Republicans totally glossed over that and just took over the spin machine and the message machine.
What you said was, where does their power come from? And you're right, that's what happened. But how did it happen? I think largely because after this great victory, and environmentalists are in power, and civil rights supporters are in power, and all the rest of it, what do we get into? We get into a second bailout for the banks. We get into a discussion about an inadequate stimulus, but how, you know, it's preferable to no stimulus at all. We see an immediate, rollback of any focus on the potential crimes, and I would say real crimes, committed by some of our most powerful institutions, mortgage brokers, bankers, banks, derivative sellers, people who literally stole people's homes and savaged our economy. You have a Democratic majority come in who will not tell, who failed to tell a story that makes any sense to people about what happened and what we need to do next.
So do you think they didn't, you know, they had a perfect opportunity there, you know, a perfect opportunity that seemed squandered. Well, were they sort of taking Barack Obama's lead that maybe they didn't want to come across as divisive? I mean, I heard
this is where you see the end of three decades of work by the right, that certain things, I mean, again, think about the State of the Union last night. You know, we have tools at our disposal as a society to even a playing field, right? And these are not, you know, socialist, communist tools. These are the standard tools of governance. Look at any part of the world. You've got taxation, you've got regulation, and you've got government planning. All of those things have been turned toxic in our society by, I would say, a very concerted campaign of media spin, think tankery, and, you know, control of the discourse through, in part, buying and selling politicians through our pay-to-play election system. So those three tools that could address, we have 15 million unemployed, more like 22 million unemployed if you count people who've given up and people who don't have the jobs that they need. We have, you know, an escalating economic and environmental crisis. And what are we going to do? We're going to embrace private corporate measures and strategies for improving the economy coming from the very people who are doing fine in the economy as it is. So you have Barack Obama talking not about a second stimulus, which is what we desperately need, but about, well, trade, and we'll reduce corporate taxation. We've had trade for 30 years, unleashed in NAFTA and before. What has happened from all that trade? Suppressed wages in this country, massive profits from lower wages, from lower production costs overseas, and the profits simply hoarded by business. So that at this point, you have something like $3 trillion simply being sat on by private companies in this country or distributed to their shareholders, not brought back in the form of new jobs, new investment, none of that in this country. And yet, what's Barack Obama promising last night? More of the same.
So what do you think the problem is? Do we not know who we elected, or is he just trying to get reelected, or what? I mean, why?
I think we have to look at...
Right?
Yeah. I mean, two things. One, it's not about him. It's about us. And I think when I wrote the Blue Grit book, which was about the progressive scene in 2006, 2007, when people were feeling pretty discouraged, well, it was started in 2004, when people were feeling discouraged after the re-election of George W., I went on a trip around the country. I was working for Air America Radio, and I heard my listeners so horrified by what had happened and just kind of giving up. And I thought, you know, it's not as bad as all that. Actually, I think there's some progressive forces kind of organizing and rising around this country. We just don't ever get to see them on our TV. So I traveled around the country and sure enough found what was happening in interesting places like you know, Salt Lake City with an environmental mayor, Montana with Native American rights, you know, Native Americans securing their right to vote, really changing the political scene in that state and electing their first Democratic governor in 16 years. You saw immigrant rights groups growing up in Florida and even Nevada, union organizations making all the difference in some of those battleground states. You know, there was a kind of mobilization that, you know, was happening at that moment. And, you know, I think that what I lost my train of thought here a little bit, but I think
the hope that you saw progressive hope out there.
Yes, there was a sense of hope. Oh, that it wasn't about him. So one of the reasons I was so in favor of Barack Obama was that I felt like he was going to empower that community because of his strategy for winning the primary campaign was very bottom up. It had to be. Hillary Clinton ruled the roost. What has happened since, I think, sadly, is that progressives kind of sat back and let Obama try to fix it for them and then judge Obama. What's he doing? How's he doing? Thumbs up, thumbs down. Really, what we need is a progressive movement in this country that says, look, we need to change our electoral system fundamentally because at this point nobody can get elected who isn't bought and paid for by the most powerful interests in the land. And when our most critical decisions have a bearing on the profits of the people who are paying for our politicians' election campaigns, we're never going to get any change that benefits the people who need it because we don't have the power that comes with the massive, mighty purse of a corporation like the Koch brothers or on the Democratic side, the health insurers, the pharmaceutical firms, the law firms. It's the old, you know, Gore-Vidal line. We don't have two parties. We have one party with one owner. There is some differences, for sure, between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. But I think this last election and the period we're living through right now, the decision by the Supreme Court and Citizens United has thrown it up in our face that unless we come to terms with money in politics, we can't expect our politicians to be the same once they're in office as they were when they were on the campaign trail. And it's really not going to be the powers that be that change this picture. It's going to have to be us. So it goes back to that old story, and we've all heard it how many times, FDR telling somebody, and it's been a variety of different people in the versions I've heard, you know, I agree with all your points of view, now make me go out and do it. That's where we're at, and
right.
It's uncomfortable, and it puts a lot of burden on us, but I don't think there's any other alternative.
Well, and one of the things I've sort of witnessed, it seems, is, well, first of all, I think we need our own progressive Tea Party, you know, whatever
mm-hmm.
we're going to call it, Green Party, I don't know what that would be, some, you know, eco-feminist movement. Oh, can you imagine Glenn Beck go out of his mind if he heard that? But the thought of that happening, it seems daunting when you have Fox News on the other side 24/7 constantly spewing hate, divisiveness, that any of these things that we would want to do would be socialism. You know, they've demonized the word socialism. You know, they've demonized, you know, everything on the left. I mean, it's almost like half the country, or maybe even a little bit more, is brainwashed. I wonder if, you know, it seems like an incredible task unless we could somehow get a liberal media outlet backed by our own billionaires.
Yeah, well, that's the dream, isn't it? I mean, I think that there's two sides to that story. You know, one is, yes, it's all as bleak as we've just portrayed. On the other hand, you know, what Molly Ivins used to say, you know, you'll look back and these were the good old days. You know, in fact, as a media person, as an independent progressive in media, I would say our situation today is much better than it was 20 years ago. You and I are talking through a medium that simply didn't exist, even just a decade back. I have a TV show that's able to be broadcast on cable and on public television and online in a way that was inconceivable, even as recent as 2000. We have an opportunity, I think, to try to keep some alternative conversations happening, but we've got an uphill battle. I mean, there's no question. We have a culture which has vilified all the things that you mentioned. In fact, we've vilified everything public, public workers, public spaces, public art. And instead, we celebrate the kind of consumerist private culture of each one for him or herself, amass everything that you can, and your value, your size in society is related to how much stuff you have. I think that one of the things that's been interesting watching the Tea Party is that many of these people, and again, leadership is different, but many of these people are people who nobody ever reached out to before. They felt alienated from politics, and maybe some of them felt alienated for racist reasons or sexist reasons or homophobic reasons that they, I don't want to glorify. But they felt left out, and a Glenn Beck says, I'm going to talk to you for an hour and explain the world. You know, I'm going to give you credit for understanding this complicated map I'm going to draw on my blackboard. And sure, it's propaganda and it's manipulation, but it's a kind of attention to folks, to people in pain and in trouble, that I think, you know, there is something there for we as progressives to learn to.
Right, right. Well, I got some information from your assistant, to give me an idea about sort of an outline about the Tea Party. And as far as their ideology, well, they seem they tend to sort of despise the poor and the weak, you know, as if we all have equal access to education and opportunity. They don't seem, at least, to be aware or about the predator aspects of the capitalism. This corporate takeover of America. You know, they complain that Obama, saved the auto industry, but then in the next breath they talk about we've lost our manufacturing base. Right. You know, they hate Michael Moore, but Michael Moore's documentaries are about corporations abandoning and preying upon Americans. You know, that they just seem, you know, they seem to be conflicted. Am I confused, or is it just it's not a cohesive group?
Well, again, A, it's not a cohesive group, and some of what they believe is not coherent. But again, I would say, how different is everything that you've just mentioned from some of the basic assumptions that have become entirely accepted, not just on the fringes of our politics, but every day? The idea that if you just pull up your bootstraps in this society, you can get ahead. That's a fundamental belief, not just of the Glenn Becks, but of the Ronald Reagans, the Bill Clintons, and frankly, the Barack Obamas too. The idea that, you know, the private person needs to be freed from the burden of society, meaning the burden of government and taxation and responsibility for your neighbors. Again, I mean, that is certainly a view that is contested among progressives, but it is increasingly a view that is mainstream. Politicians, when was the last time you heard a politician get up and defend taxation?
Well, but I wonder if it's become mainstream simply because it's been repeated over and over and over and over and over again.
Absolutely, and not contested, because you've got such a climate of viciousness in our media and politics that, you know, there's been no echo chamber for the person that gets up and says, actually, you know what, taxes are the membership fees we pay to live in a humane society, and I'm happy to pay those fees, and in fact, we want to make sure that everybody pays them, so everybody feels an equal part of the society, because it's in helping one another that we help ourselves, we feel stronger. When was the last time you heard somebody say that? Well, maybe it's because, you know, we do not have a media playing field that is, you know, anywhere near balanced, and anybody who would agree with that point of view never gets heard.
But they're always crying that the media is liberal.
That is easy to disprove.
Well, right. Well, and the other thing about it is, I would suspect that most of these people are supposed to be Christian. It's almost as if the Christian values, the Jesus values, you know, they sort of go out of the window when it comes to politics, it would seem.
No, absolutely. But again, I would say this is what we've been hearing for years. You know, that to be a Christian, it's still okay to wage war on your neighbors. It's still okay to resort to armed conflict as a solution for, you know, economic division, for a humanitarian crisis. We can be good interventionists in Iraq and Yugoslavia. You know, we've heard it from both sides of the political aisle. But you know, there's no question, and people should pick up at the Tea Party, which is not an apology for Tea Party, as by any means it will lay out all the contradictions. I've just thought more and more as I've watched our society, you know, go through even just these last 6 months, about how much of what we vilify as over there is really right here, is really deep now in our political culture, and has to be really examined and dug up by the roots. It goes back to the fundamental notion of society and what society is about and what American society was founded about. When you hear some of these Tea Partiers claim the mantle of the founders, the mantle is, you know, save us from big government. Well, actually, you know, it wasn't the individual who created the American society. It was the individual in consort with his or her and her neighbors creating a government that actually was about protecting the everyman from massive power, monarchy, private interests, private wealth. If you go back and read the founders, it was about government to protect you, the individual, everyman, member of the democratic society, from the super powerful. It wasn't about protecting the individual from government.
Well, there, Lord. So there's another point. Just like with the birthers, I wonder if it's that they're are they just uninformed or disingenuous, or it's working for them, so they don't really care. They're just going to, they don't have an interest in setting the record straight. Because, I mean, let's face it, wouldn't Hillary or McCain have dug up that kind of stuff on Obama if, you know, there was really an issue of his birth certificate? I mean, it seems ludicrous.
Eric Cantor was on Meet the Press this weekend, and, you know, he was challenged. David Gregory actually did challenge somebody for once and said, don't you want to call this crazy talk? For once and for all, there's still this view out here about the birth certificate and the citizenship. And Eric Cantor would say, you know, the new House Majority Leader would say, well, I believe that Barack Obama's a citizen, but I don't want to call anybody crazy. He called the health care plan crazy, as Ed Schultz mm-hmm. pointed out the other night. It's a way of keeping a distraction, and it's also a distraction. I mean, I said it last night. I mean, Barack Obama is born and made in America. The real problem that we have is that very few other things are born and made in America, that we have an employment crisis, a manufacturing crisis. That's what we need to be talking about. But as long as we can keep talking and permit this conversation to keep going, that's A, keeping the sort of, you know, lighter fuel alive, and B, it's a distraction from what we really need to be talking about. Because so what? We find out, we find Barack Obama's birth certificate or not. You know, it's been found a million times. The Hawaiian government has been bending over backwards to produce the documentation. It's been produced. But none of this conversation changes the reality of people's lives. And I think that's part of what this is about. And Eric Cantor's evasion, well, that's, you know, trying to be a good birther boy and keep the Tea Party crew fighting for you, not against you, which is the important
right.
thing.
Well, so what do we do, Laura? I mean, what methods should the left employ? I read an article just today that I think it was George Lakoff.
Mm-hmm.
He had an article out called "Untellable Truths," you know, and he talked about, you know, we should be changing the message to just our phrasing. You know, I think he's an author of I think he's into neurolinguistics, and he mm-hmm. said we should be calling it a greed crisis instead of economic crisis. Mm-hmm. We should be saying blessed immigrants in place of illegal immigrants, government for profit, not privatization, public theft in place of tax breaks, failing citizens in place of failing schools, corporate cruelty in place of profit maximization. You know, and somebody else said, I think it was Jeff Chang and Brian Comart of the American Prospect, that, you know, we can beat conservatism with progressive culture and our creativity. I mean, that, you know, these all seem like maybe pieces of the puzzle, but I think we need more than that, don't we?
Well, I think we need not just language but law. I think we need to bring some of these basically corporate criminals on Wall Street and elsewhere into the dock. You know, let's not be talking about deregulation when we need to be bringing people like the heads of Massey Energy, who are responsible for the kind of unsafe practices that stole the lives of 29 miners earlier last year, or around about this time last year. We need not just congressional hearings, we need legal hearings. We need to take some strong action, I think, to repudiate some of the practices of the Bush administration. But then, as we've talked about before, Karen, we need to build an independent media movement that provides a place for some of these conversations, for some of the culture that Jeff's talking about, for some of the real challenges to the conventional wisdom that need to be had. You know, we get so nervous in our electoral cycle of, oh, we can't be critical of our guy or our woman on the ballot. I think right now we have to get very critical of our electoral system, and we need to start trying to work with our neighbors to change that. We need to be working locally. The answer is the same as it's always been. You think globally, you work locally. In this last midterm, some of the only victories, you know, some of the key victories for Democrats were in places, like Arizona, where you had good progressives challenged at the last minute, and only because they had an existing ground team and long-term relationship with their voters on the ground were they able to beat back Tea Party attacks. You know, it's the same politics we have to go back to that work for progressives and always have. Work locally, work with your talk to your neighbors, come out with your political views, with your cultural views, talk to people. And my one fear about the Tea Party phenomenon and our response to it is that we will again become terrified of the people we live amongst and stop talking to one another, which I think is a disaster.
Right. Well, do you honestly think, though, with the deck stacked so much as it is, I mean, we have the conservative Supreme Court, we have Citizens United, Fox News, all of the money, that's, coming into the Republican Party from corporations. I mean, what are the chances that we can actually get campaign finance reform or any of these things? It almost seems like it's so deeply entrenched. It would take a nuclear bomb to wiggle it free.
Well, ask the people of Tunisia if they ever thought they were going to be free of their dictator, or the people right now protesting in Cairo, were they ever going to see the Mubaraks, pack up and fly to Heathrow? I mean, there's been a sense in this society, I think, that we need change. We need it right now, and if we didn't get it yesterday, then it must not work and we're going to go home. We're seeing at the local level efforts around campaign financing, public financing of elections in Portland and New Hampshire and Vermont. Vermont, this last month, passed a law that will, I think, demand an exercise in single-payer health care. There are interesting initiatives happening at the local level that we can learn from. Is it possible today to figure out how to unravel the Citizens United decision? Well, even there are initiatives around a constitutional amendment that at least concentrate the mind on where the problem is. We need government for the people, by the people. We need tools to stop corporations not just breaking our laws and stealing our homes, but rewriting our electoral laws and stealing our home of our democracy. There's work to be done, that's absolutely no question. And you and I and people like us, we need to maintain the media outlets that give that kind of conversation an airing. And of course, everybody needs to pick up At the Tea Party from orbooks.com.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit about the media. First of all, what exactly happened a few years back under under George Bush's administration that even allowed a foreigner to come to own so much of America's media? Wasn't that kind of a fishy arrangement in itself, or was that all above board? That
Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch?
Right, right.
Well, I hate to tell you that most of the damage done to our media structure was done under the Clinton administration in 1996 with the telecommunications law of that year, for which, let's say, the communications companies paid an enormous amount in campaign contributions to the head of the committees, the Commerce and other committees that were responsible for coming up with that law. But it was during that period that I think you saw the most dramatic weakening of the regulations on A, how large a corporation could be, I mean, how many television and radio stations they could own, but B, you know, cross-ownership, could you own a radio station, TV station, and a newspaper in the same town? You know, now we're in a situation where we've leapt forward once again, and again it's under a Democratic president, to a point where you can have a company that produces content own the pipes that distribute that content as long as they promise they won't promote their own content over others. Well, you know, I'll believe that, you know, for as long as it, you know, I won't believe that for very long. The question of how Rupert Murdoch got the laws changed was less about his citizenship than about exactly that, the group, the ownership rules, which were in many cases throughout that period and to today written explicitly to not step on his toes, to not restrict his you know, not roll back the purchases that he'd already made. Many of which were illegal when he made them.
Well, and I'd like to talk a little bit about the, maybe the media's role in potentially, you know, escalating, not escalating, but elevating the Tea Party. I mean, like, for instance, last night after the State of the Union, CNN runs Michelle Bachmann's response, you know, as if the Tea Party is, you know, the equivalent of the other two major parties. I mean, is that going down, you know, okay in your mind?
I think you're absolutely right. I think there are people who are beginning to wake up to this and say, wait a minute, Sarah Palin is a, you know, a quitter governor from Alaska with no chance in most people's eyes of running for, of getting elected president, and yet she's treated as if she's not only, you know, she gets as much, she's a failed candidate for vice president who gets more media attention than the actual vice president. And it's not just the leadership. We saw CNN, Wolf Blitzer, rush down to Delaware to cover one of the election debates with Christine O'Donnell. Christine O'Donnell didn't stand a chance of winning in Delaware, and yet there was the media attention, the media focus. And that goes back to my point that it's not necessarily about the person, it's about the politics. And through the attention to these people, we're seeing a reinscribing with a certain kind of political, you know, a publicity given to a certain kind of political point of view that goes way beyond the candidacy of that individual. And it's not just the candidates. I mean, as I said in the book, you've got the, you know, the same media that pay no attention to, you know, marches for choice on Capitol Hill, or marches for gay and lesbian equality, or marches for immigrant rights, all of which attracted in the last few years 500,000, 750,000, 1,000,000 people at a time, showering attention on Glenn Beck's rallies that were, at best estimates, around 100,000 or fewer on the mall two times around. You're absolutely right. There's an immediate imbalance. And you've got to wonder, you know, not just at the amount of coverage, but at the quality of coverage. I mean, that goes back to race again. If it was young people of color carrying some of the banners, calling the president a Nazi, calling the president, you know, a fascist, or a socialist, if they can just make up their mind, I don't think
guns.
We would see the kind of attention carrying guns, exactly. I don't think you would see the quality of coverage, let alone, you might see the quantity in that case, but it wouldn't happen twice.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Keith Olbermann. You know, obviously those of us on the left are lamenting his departure, but worse than his departure, you know, we've become worried that maybe this is the beginning of the end of liberals actually having a voice, considering conservative Comcast, you know, has merged with NBC. Do you think that's, you know, just paranoia, or do you think that's a real worry?
I think it's an absolutely real worry, and we have every reason to believe that there was a role played by the corporate executives in this case. And if they don't want us to believe that, well, hard luck on them, because whether it's true or not, it's on the, you know, it is on their backs to prove that it isn't what happened, because it's exactly the reasons that we're skeptical of commercial media and of corporate control over our news outlets. This is the reason why we have to maintain independent, non-commercial, community-supported advertising-free radio and television, because there's always going to be the question: oh, was it because of something somebody said that alienated the owners or the advertisers? In this case, I don't think we really know. I think that Keith Olbermann was 8 years at MSNBC. It's a pretty good long run for him. Was he certainly an irritant for their corporate interests? For sure. Was his own personal, interpersonal skills problematic? Well, I've heard that too. The point is that if we've been thinking that corporate media would bring us the liberal voice that will be an alternative to the other guys, you know, it was never true. It wasn't even true when Keith Olbermann was on the air. And it's not going to be true in the future. We have to build our own that can be insulated from that kind of pressure. And then you don't have to wonder, you know, when Laura's taken off the air, is it because of some corporate owner? No, it's probably because the viewer contributions didn't come through. You know, we have got to build an independent media where progressives can have a voice, and which is not, at the behest of General Electric.
Well, and it would be nice if, half of the country could wake up to the idea that we're really looking out for them, too.
Yeah.
That's really kind of the sad point. Well, Laura, if there would be one final important idea you'd like to leave with my listeners, maybe I haven't asked you, what would that be?
Well, you've asked lots of great questions. But again, I think, we can't just assert that there is a sensible middle in society or a, benevolent left. We can't just sort of have marches on the mall, as the folks from The Daily Show did, to restore sanity. We actually have to do the local work like Raul Grijalva did that I was talking about in Arizona, or the local work that's seeing, healthcare initiatives come to fruition in Vermont. And we have to have a counter-media strategy. We can't simply be focusing on the evils of the other guy. We have to make our own. And then, finally, we have to convene our own conversations and our own, deliver, and our own and create our own narrative for what's happening. It's easy to critique the other guys. I think we need to get very clear about what's happened in this country and what possible proposals exist out there to resolve it. Technology alone won't save us. We've got to save us, and I think that's what this is all about.
Well, and I can't help but think, too, that the left seems to be I think we're a little bit more live and let live, and we don't like this authoritarian right style. We also tend to not support one another, where the right sticks together like the Borg, and sometimes that seems like that's our weakness as well. We won't stick together; we'll fragment, and I don't know. Maybe there's something in that as well.
Well, we believe in diversity. But you're absolutely right. We have to also figure out some priorities. And I think a number one priority at this point is taking back our elections from the Citizens United crowd. And let's not forget what Citizens United originally stood for. Do you remember when we talk about Hillary Clinton? That was the case that the Supreme Court decided last year, opening the floodgates for anonymous corporate money in our elections. And it was about a film that was made about Hillary Clinton by a company that now go by the name of Citizens United, but were originally named Citizens United Not Timid. And the acronym was to make a point about Hillary Clinton. And as you are the voice of, ecofeminism out there, I think it's important that we remember that it is in the worst kind of misogyny that this decision is rooted, and we shouldn't let them forget it.
Well, that is definitely forgotten, Laura. And you know what? Somebody just shot me an email. They said, "Why does the Tea Party have such an appeal to women?" You know, I guess assuming you know we're not thinking Sarah Palin and Michelle Bachmann or the average woman.
I think
there's something
you picked
in
up
particular.
The book. There's a great chapter in there by Betsy Reed where she says it's simply not true. It's asserted that women have flocked to the Tea Party. The numbers don't reflect it at all. It's majority male. It's majority better off. It's majority older, according to every poll. But if you want to think about why women who do go there go there, the only thing I would suggest is there are a lot of women who feel they've been badly treated, well, either in their lives and they've never been involved in anything political, and this is the first group that reached out to them, or it's the first time in a fairly unorganized new formulation that women have been able to take leadership before the guys take over, or people who are actually frustrated and fed up with how women get treated in the Democratic Party. That's a whole other story. But the fundamental fact is it's not true. It's a male-led, it's a male-dominated movement with some female figureheads.
Okay. And one last time, let's make sure listeners know how to find your book.
You can get the book at Or Books. Just think of, you know, TV Or Books, orbooks.com.
Okay. And grittv.org, they can find you there every day on the Internet, correct?
They can. Absolutely.
Well, Laura, it has been my pleasure. Thank you so much for your time tonight. And I look forward to seeing you tomorrow.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Thanks, Karen.
All right, good night. Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just might save the world. And you've been listening to Laura Flanders of Grit TV discussing her book, At the Tea Party, shedding light on the ideology and backing of the Tea Party and how liberals might just take back the messaging. Well, it's that time when we're crossing the threshold into the next part of the show, when I take a very brief 1 minute music break to get ready for my What's the Buzz segment. I hope you'll stay tuned in with me for the next 60 seconds, because I'm going to let you listen to a wonderful song by Zingaya called Breath of Passion. Stay with me. I'll be back in a minute. I'm back. Thanks for staying with me for this short What's the Buzz segment tonight. I'd like to share an article with you first. It was in the New York Times, and it's by Pamela Paul. And the gist of it is, the rich don't get how the other half lives. And the article is entitled, As for Empathy, the Haves Have Not. And it's dated December 30th. I've been meaning to share with this with you for a while, but I just haven't had time with usually two guests on a night. I'm sure you can find it in the archives at the New York Times. Like I said, dated December 30th. Anyway, What the article says is the upper classes, or they're asked, they pose the question, are the upper classes really indifferent to the hopes, fears, and miseries of ordinary folk, or is it that they just don't understand their less privileged peers? Well, according to a paper by three psychological researchers, Michael Krauss at the University of California in San Francisco, Stephanie Cote at the University of Toronto, and Dasher Keltner at the University of California in Berkeley, members of the upper class are less adept at reading emotions. They say research on psychological effects of social status is recent in this country, where the mere mention of class can set off Marxism alarms. Dr. Keltner says, only in the last 7 or 8 years have we tried to capture all the nuances of the differences between the ways the rich and the poor experience the world psychologically. It's really a new science. Well, the paper was published in October by the Association for Psychological Science, and it recounts three experiments conducted among students and employees of a large, unidentified public university, some of whom had graduated from college and others who hadn't. In American social science, the definition of class is generally based on measures like income, occupational prestige, and material wealth. Well, in these experiments, class was determined either by educational level or by self-reported perceptions of family socioeconomic status. In the first experiment, participants were asked to look at pictures of faces and indicate which emotions were being expressed. The more upper class the judges, the less able they were to accurately identify emotions in others. In another experiment, upper-class participants had a harder time reading the emotions of strangers during simulated job interviews. And the third one, an interesting twist of an experiment, people of greater socioeconomic status were asked to compare themselves to the wealthiest, most powerful Americans, thus diminishing their own relative stature. When asked to identify emotions by looking at 36 sets of emoting eyes, they did markedly better than their upper-class peers. Well, here's why. Earlier studies have suggested that those in the lower classes, unable to simply hire others, rely more on neighbors or relatives for things like a ride to work or child care, and as a result, the authors propose, they have to develop more effective social skills, ones that will engender goodwill. Dr. Keltner says is upper class people, in spite of all their advantages, suffer empathy deficits, and there are enormous consequences. In other words, a high powered lawyer or chief executive ill equipped to pick up on more subtle emotions doesn't make for a sympathetic boss. Let's see, it goes on to say, in apocryphal but oft-cited exchange, Hemingway supposed the rich to be different only because they had more money. But as Fitzgerald rather precisely wrote in his history, Rich Boy, because the wealthy possess and enjoy early, it does something to them, surmising they are different from you and me. Well, score one for Scott. Okay, well, it looks like I might have someone calling in. I will identify you by your area code, 917. I'm going to unmute you and see if you have a question.
Yes, I've been listening to your show. Do you really think that the Tea Party is a bunch of wing nuts and all that?
Laura's off the line now, and so you've got me, not her. I'm afraid she left us a few minutes ago. Are you asking my personal opinion?
Well, I mean, you're part of the show, but anyway, do you favor redistributing the wealth?
Well, this is what I think. I mean, you heard Laura talk, and I'm sure you've probably seen all the charts out there. The middle class has been flat or or disappearing for years now. And the rich get wealthier and wealthier. They're benefiting from society, you know, without paying their, you know, probably their rightful portion. And because they're buying our politicians, you know, they get laws in their favor, they get tax laws in their favor, they get regulation in their favor. And it's gotten to the point where things are out of balance. And, you know, there's something to be said. I mean, if you want to call it redistributing the wealth, well, I mean, that's a Glenn Beck term. He loves to throw that around as if it's a horrible thing. But there is something to be said for, you know, having fairness, for social justice, for all, you know, for there being a level playing field. And when 1% of the country has the majority of the wealth and other people are underemployed or can't find jobs or they're going bankrupt because they can't pay for health care, there's something fundamentally wrong in how everything is structured and the fairness in our society.
Here's the thing. I mean, leftists love to say the rich, but they seem unable to define
exactly
what the
rich is. No, there's a lot of rich people on the left. There's a lot of rich people on the left, but they're
much of the rich is in the forefront promoting left-wing cause. You're right about that. Much of the rich is in the forefront promoting left-wing causes. Like, look at Hollywood, for example.
I mean, you have George Clooney, who cares about people in Africa having clean water to drink. You have a lot of celebrities who put their name to causes. I mean, look at Bono. There are a lot of, you know, the right is very much survival of the fittest. You know, you should be able to do it all on your own, as if, you know, there's a level playing field out there and everybody has the same advantages. That's not true. You know, it's simply not true. And I think, you know, a lot of people who maybe grow up with wealth, they don't have any idea what it's like to try to make up your mind if the last few dollars you have in your bank account this month, if you're going to buy medicine with it or if you're going to buy groceries. I mean, the right also doesn't seem to think that, you know, government should protect the weak and the vulnerable. You know, I guess it's okay, old lady, if, you know, you can't make it on Social Security, if you, you know, didn't get rich in your life, well, yeah, just go ahead and eat cat food. You know, I mean, millions of children go to bed hungry in this country. 70% of women retire in poverty. This is supposed to be the best country in the world. You know, with statistics, I mean, people ignore those sorts of statistics. And, you know, and those are the kinds of things I think people on the left want to change. We just want a level playing field, that's all. We want a caring culture.
It is horrible when people go hungry and all that. We all agree there. But the thing is, the left doesn't want to level the playing field. The left wants to exploit people with less money. They want to exploit minorities and all of that.
I don't think
and
that's
true. And I
already
explained that a billion times. Here is
I don't
the,
think that's
here,
true.
Here
I'm on the left,
though.
And there's no basis in fact there. I mean, I consider myself on the left.
Now, look at how the left is treating minority conservatives, particularly black conservatives, how they bash them day in and day out.
I don't know anything about that. It's, you know, when you tune into a Republican convention versus a Democratic convention, where do you see all the white faces and where do you see diversity? You see diversity on the left. You don't see diversity on the right.
Whoa, wait. That's so absurd.
I guess you haven't tuned into a convention lately.
The left, including the Democrats, are controlling minority communities and telling these minorities, support us or else you are all self-hating traitors or something like that.
I don't know if anybody's saying that, sir. But I thank you for calling in and expressing your opinion. Okay, well, going back to my What's the Buzz segment, I wanted to save this portion of the show to talk to you about Keith Olbermann. There are two articles here that I thought were two of the better ones that talked about his leaving. The first is written by Mitchell Bard. He's a writer and filmmaker, and it was on the Huffington Post, and I'm going to read you some excerpts from his article and then a second article that from William Rivers Pitt from Truthout. But anyway, the first one by Mitchell Bard, his article was titled "A Tribute to Olbermann, Why He's Different from the Pundits at Fox." And he goes on to say, an analysis of how MSNBC, which uses a traditional journalistic approach to report facts, but then ditching objectivity, critically assesses how the facts compare with the progressive take on issues, differs from Fox News, essentially a right-wing propaganda operation pretending to practice journalism with no allegiance to facts, is a book-length endeavor and beyond the scope of a blog piece, but Olbermann's approach reflects the difference between the two networks. Anyone charging that Olbermann's show was equivalent to Beck's clearly hasn't watched either of them. Olbermann wasn't objective, but he was honest about it, not disingenuously claiming to be fair and balanced. But his shows were well-researched and relied on facts to make his progressive points. To be sure, Olbermann used inflammatory language, and he wasn't always as respectful as some thought he should be. But when he railed about something, he relied on quotes and polls and statistics and history, unlike the concocted charges offered by Beck as facts to make his point. The author, Mitchell Bard, goes on to say, to me, that was what made Olbermann such an essentially important commentator, especially during the Bush administration. Much focus is directed at how Olbermann made his points, his combative tone, his aggressive language, etc. But it was the fact-based content that really mattered and separated him from his right-wing counterparts. The reason the founders accorded the press the protections of the First Amendment was under the belief that the press was, as Jeffrey Smith described it, quote, a lash for government and a pride for the people, unquote. Under this point of view, government was rendered more stable by a free press since it exposed problems and allowed for reform, preserving the liberties of the people. What Olbermann did on his show day in and day out was to carry out that function, shining a light on elected officials of both parties. Yes, he was a lash for government and a pride for the people. Most definitely. I watched him just about every night. And with Olbermann's departure, commentators will be going on, I'm sure, looking for an easy story, lumping him in with other pundits who shared a combative tone without going the next step to describe the very different content of the show. It's these false equivalencies that have really been very annoying. These writers will simplistically decry hyper-partisanship, like the Daily Beast did, as if Olbermann and Beck were interchangeable. And Mitchell Bard goes on to say, instead, I will pay tribute to Olbermann for the important role he played over the last 8 years. I want to use this space to say thank you to Olbermann. Thank you for your humor and insight, which is consistently smart and observant. Thank you for giving voice to the anger so many of us felt during the Bush presidency when few on television would do so. People accuse you of being over the top, but when bad things are happening in the government or media and too many are ignoring them, I don't want political commentators to be subtle. Hear, hear. I totally agree. Thank you for talking about the lies and the fake journalism at Fox News when so many of us knew it was going on, but few on television would talk about it. Thank you for always backing up your charges with facts at a time when so many television news personality, especially at Fox News, don't care about facts. Thank you for having the guts to share your experiences navigating the healthcare system at the time your father was dying, despite the personal pain doing so must have caused. Also, you could educate viewers about the real experiences of those interacting with the system. And thank you for regularly standing up for what was right, regardless of the consequences. You may not carry the objective legacy of Edward R. Murrow, whose good night and good luck you borrowed as your sign-off line. You might not carry that objective legacy into the 21st century, but you certainly embody his commitment to journalists, playing the role of a shining light on the workings of government to ensure the American people have the information they need to be informed citizens. You consistently labor to urge politicians to act for the betterment of the country, adhering to long-standing American values of justice, equality, and fairness. Thank you. And as I said, there were two articles. The other one was by William Rivers Pitt on truthout.org. That's truthout.org. William Rivers Pitt wrote the article, The Olbermann Era, and I'm just going to read you a few excerpts. To me and so many others, he was a beacon of sanity during the bleak darkness of the Bush years. Remember the timeline here. The 2000 election catastrophe was followed by a ceaseless cable news refrain of, this is an orderly transition of power, nothing to see here, go back to bed. Well, Mr. Olbermann was one of the only voices in broadcasting who openly discussed the outing of CIA agent Valerie Plame by the Bush administration. When the 2004 election results in Ohio were corrupted by brazen manipulation and vote fraud, it was Olbermann who raised the loudest televised cry. It was Olbermann who, day after day, hammered the awful truth about the invasion and occupation of Iraq. And it was Olbermann who pounded home the fact that the Bush administration was little more than a deranged criminal enterprise that threatened the very fabric of the nation. For me, Mr. Olbermann delivered his most memorable, impassioned, and important special comment in 2006 in the aftermath of George W. Bush's press conference in the Rose Garden, in which Bush played the Nazi card and essentially implied that anyone who disagreed with him and his policies was an ally of Al-Qaeda. Well, Mount Olbermann erupted, and I'm not going to read his whole special comment here. I'm sure you can probably find it on YouTube, or you can go to this truthout.org article and find it. But it, among all of his other special comments, were outstanding. And he closed the piece with, "Have you no sense of decency, sir?" Which he directed at George Bush. The manner of Mr. Olbermann's departure remains shrouded in mystery. The man himself has made no comment on the matter of his leaving MSNBC, which may have something to do with the deal that was cut to end his contract 2 years early. Many have opined, correctly in all likelihood, that the looming Comcast takeover of NBC Universal played a large role. As BuzzFlash editor Mark Carlin wrote over the weekend, according to James Wolcott of Vanity Fair, the chairman of Comcast, Spectacor, Ed Snyder, is funding a right-wing cable channel / internet site called Right Network. Wolcott sniffs at Right Network as a pseudo-populist operation starring an array of right-wing freaks. Ominously, Wolcott notes that it was Snyder who invited Sarah Palin to drop the hucky puck at the Flyers season opener in 2008, and Palin has been dropping pucks ever since. There's little reason to doubt that Olbermann's abrupt exit from MSNBC was the first puck to drop as Comcast slapshots MSNBC away from being a progressive beachhead. The second reason is simple. In one man we find the confluence of so many pressing issues. Mr. Olbermann stands at the center of the dire need for and the dire lack of progressive voices within mainstream news broadcasting. He threw his shoulder against the wall of corporate hypocrisy. He stood and bellowed against the misdeeds of those in political power, and ultimately he stands today as the likely victim of the continued right-wing domination of the news media. People are understandably outraged and disturbed over his abrupt and ill-defined departure. So how, in the face of all this, can he justify his me reaction? Well, that he's referring to something he said earlier in the column where he just doesn't like cable news at all. But then he goes on to say, Keith Olbermann is not dead. He was not beamed to Neptune, never to be seen or heard from again. Write it down, carve it in stone, make a note, and bet the form. Olbermann will be back. Somewhere, somehow, someday, in one form or another, Mr. Olbermann will be with us again. We will hear or read his words on the matter of his departure, and then we will hear him again and again and again. Giants do not fall easily, and this particular era of political commentary is not over by a long chalk. Edward R. Murrow had his own troubles with management in the darkness of the McCarthy days, and it did not keep him down or silent one iota. So shall it be with Mr. Olbermann in these dark days of corporate hegemony. Well, in that vein of thought, let me say, Keith, you are such a brave way shower, clearing the way with your machete through the thicket of lies and propaganda. We miss you, and we are counting down the weeks until you return. Assuming the best, you will only be gone 6 months. Then we only have to wait 24 weeks until your return. And may your return be with a bang. Let this ending be the beginning of something bigger, better, and even more influential. Until then, I have your bobblehead doll on my desk. So, listeners, listen close, because you can still hear Keith's voice.
Let's play oddball. Which of these stories will you be talking about tomorrow? Today's worst person in the world!
Well, that's the Keith we know and love, and the Keith who will soon be back. Well, thank you, listeners. Thank you for tuning in tonight, and I hope you'll be back with me next Wednesday. My two guests will be Maka Nightmare. She is an elder in the pagan community, and she is going to be talking about the goddess Bridget at this particular time of the year, as well as building pagan community. And in the second part of the show, I'm going to have Carl Ruck on. He is a noted classicist who is known for his book, The Road to Eleusis, where he uncovers what he believes were the rituals and trance-inducing work that was done in the Demeter and Persephone cults of ancient Greece. So I think both of our listeners, both of our guests will have much for listeners to tune in for. Very interesting stuff. So, as I close the show tonight, let's see, I think I will close it with something nice. Hang on, let's see here. How about I close it with Om Sekhmet by Abigail Spinner McBride? Good night, listeners. Look forward to next Wednesday.